you know, your ears begin to ring walking around these polling stations because everyone is chanting things like, you know, our blood, our souls will give for you Saddam, and yes, yes, yes to the leader Saddam Hussein. But then when you start talking to people individually, the number one thing that they talk about is not their love for the president, it's their hatred for George W. Bush, his father, the Clinton administration.
It's the wrong war. It's being approached the wrong way. It's arrogant.
People who resist war are much truer patriots than people who support war.
We don't want another war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. I'm Verna Avery Brown. France and Russia are considering a new U.S. Security Council resolution on Iraq, with Moscow saying for the first time today that it might agree to military action if Baghdad fails to cooperate with weapons inspections. In an effort to end a five-week impasse among the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, the United States, supported by Britain, dropped a demand that a resolution explicitly to authorize military force against Iraq. U.N. analyst Susan Wood says no formal resolution has been presented, so the exact wording is not known.
What the U.S. wants is to say that as soon as it's determined that Iraq has somehow failed to comply with UN weapons inspectors, and it's not clear who would make that determination. Presumably, there would be a report to the Security Council that Iraq has failed to comply in some manner. But remember that the U.S. up to now has insisted that any permanent member of the Security Council be allowed to accompany the weapons inspectors in Iraq. So there's all kinds of potential there for incidents to occur. And as one analyst that I read in the Guardian of London today said, you know, with this new resolution, the U.S. is setting up a red line, and they're just waiting for Iraq to cross it. Should that occur, the U.S. would then say that it's prepared to consult with the other members of the Security Council. But it would not need to wait for a second vote. It would not need to wait for authorization. That's the real crux of the matter.
The new offer was designed to win support from the other three permanent members of the Council, France, Russia, and China, which want to give Iraq a chance to cooperate with weapons inspectors without the threat of force. As the U.S. plots regime change in Iraq, the people of Iraq have declared Saddam Hussein the winner of the presidential election Wednesday with 100% of the votes in. It was a referendum in which he was the sole candidate on the ballot, and the election perpetuates his two-decade reign and prompted bursts of celebration in the streets of Baghdad. Jeremy Scahill is a freelance reporter in Iraq. We spoke with him earlier today from his location in Baghdad. Jeremy, I wanted to talk to you about the re-election of Saddam Hussein. He was, of course, re-elected this week by a 100% vote. Your coverage indicates that you were present during much of the voting in Saddam's hometown. How much support was there for Saddam outside of his hometown?
Well, I mean, I think that this is a very complicated issue right now. Certainly, there are many, many people inside of Iraq who hate the president of this country, and there are many, many people in this country who do not hate the president of this country. But what I think was a dynamic that has to be discussed is these daily and constant threats from the Bush administration. Throughout the country, many, many people were voting yes for Saddam Hussein as a way of voting no to George W. Bush. He was sort of the phantom candidate in these elections, if you will, given that there was only one person on the ballot, and that was Saddam Hussein. Now, did Saddam Hussein get 100% of the vote? I think that's highly unlikely. But I do think that the overwhelming majority of people in this country, in a non-coerced way, did go to the polls and voted yes for Saddam Hussein. And it was a a major vote of no for George W. Bush. Mm.
Of course, as you've pointed out, he was the only name on the ballot. Do you suppose the Iraqi people understood that it's either Saddam or some U.S. militarily imposed puppet like General Tommy Franks, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the number one thing that I heard at the polls. I mean, you know, your ears begin to ring walking around these polling stations because everyone is chanting things like, you know, our blood, our souls will give for you Saddam, and yes, yes, yes to the leader Saddam Hussein. But then when you start talking to people individually, the number one thing that they talk about is not their love for the president, it's their hatred for George W. Bush, his father, the Clinton administration, and certainly people are extremely well informed of the minutiae of what's going on at the United Nations. They're very well aware of the reports in the New York Times and elsewhere that the U.S. intends to impose a military governor on Iraq. The other thing, Verna, that's interesting to point out is that this style of confirming the president rather than electing him through what might be called in the West democracy was not something that the regime of Saddam Hussein thought up. The first time that a referendum of this sort was held in Iraq was in 1921, and it was sponsored by the British colonialists who were here. They held a referendum on the puppet government of King Faisal I. So it was, in fact, the British who created this system of confirming the leader within Iraq. And it also must be said that this is the form of quote-unquote elections throughout the Arab world. It's how Hosni Mubarak, one of the leading allies of the United States in this region, how he is quote-unquote elected. It's how the Syrian government is reconfirmed. All of the governments in this region, if they even have elections. Saudi Arabia doesn't have elections. So this is not something that, you know, as has been indicated in so many of the media reports, is an indicator of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. Rather, it's the way business is done in this world.
Jeremy, many progressive analysts and humanitarian workers actually in Iraq who are hoping to minimize the impact of the deadly sanctions, and even some U.S. congressmen. I would cite Jim McDermott and David Bonnier, who visited Baghdad and opposed the U.S. war agenda. They all say that, you know, while everyone knows Saddam is no saint, there's no real love for him among the Iraqi people. But that regime change should be a part of the goal. Now, as a journalist who's traveling throughout the country, how do you interpret the support for Saddam Hussein? Is he all they know? Is he the lesser of two evils, with the U.S., of course, being the other evil? Or are they supporting him out of fear of government retaliation?
No, I mean, I think that this is a man who has a tremendous level of support in this country. I do not believe that it's true that all of the Iraqi people hate him and just can't wait until he's gone. Look, you have 3 million members of the Ba'ath Party, of the ruling party in this country, that live here. These are 3 million people whose entire livelihoods depend on him being the president or the Ba'ath Party ruling this country. If Saddam Hussein were to fall, those people have no political tomorrow, and they may not even have a literal tomorrow because of the years of perceived repression by them. And so the fact is that there's at least 3 million Ba'athists who are willing to die and defy for Saddam Hussein. In his home city of Tikrit, I think he has overwhelming support, as he does through much of the center of Iraq. It's once you get down to the south of Iraq where there is bitterness and hatred for the government. But the fact is that the south of Iraq, where it's a majority Shia Muslim, they are the victims of regular bombing by the United States, and it's the people that are most devastated by the sanctions. So where there was support in 1991 after the Gulf War for toppling Saddam Hussein, now here we are 11 years later, broken American promises, ongoing bombings, devastating sanctions, cancer rates soaring because of the U.S. use of depleted uranium weapons. People want nothing to do with the United States. And so what the U.S. has done in its policy since the Gulf War here is to make the central government in Baghdad very, very strong. And I think the overwhelming voter turnout that we saw in Iraq is indicative of exactly how constructive American policy has been.
You said there are 3 million members of the Ba'ath Party. What about opposition parties? Are there any that you have been able to see mobilizing or operating freely there?
And under the territory in Iraq that's controlled by the government of Saddam Hussein, it is unthinkable that there would be any public representation of opposition. Totally unthinkable. No one would dare even make a sign that called for, you know, lowering the price of electricity. People are terrified at the idea of publicly opposing this government. Let's be clear about that. There are opposition groups that are abroad that have more of a constituency along the Potomac, where you are, Verna, than they do along the Tigris or Euphrates here. Some of them are people who are war criminals, basically, and now they're trying to make a political people tomorrow for themselves. Some of them are crooks who are wanted in Jordan, like Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress. There is no Northern Alliance that is going to form or be formed in Iraq. But to reiterate, Verna, no such thing as public opposition here at all.
Now, by Northern Alliance, you're referring to the organization that took over in Afghanistan after the U.S. bombed that country. You said earlier that there are 3 million members of the Ba'ath Party that are whose livelihood is intricately connected to the success of Saddam Hussein. I know that you spoke with members of the Ba'ath Party recently. Can you share some of that interview with us?
Yeah, we talked to a man who was a former federal minister. He was the former Iraqi ambassador to France, a man named Dr. Abdul Al-Hashimi. He's the president of an organization right now called the Organization for Peace, Solidarity, and Friendship, and he's been traveling, one of the Iraqis who has been on the front of diplomacy on behalf of the central government here, traveling to Russia, France, and several other European cities trying to mobilize opposition to U.S. attacks. And one of the things that I talked to him about was these threats that the United States has been making about invading Iraq. And you mentioned General Tommy Franks and the idea of a military governor. And he raised in the course of discussion on his trip abroad that he thinks the U.S. is running the risk of sparking demonstrations that supersede the size of protests during the Vietnam War. And when he said that, I said to him, do you think that if U.S. troops came into Iraq, that they would face a fate similar to the thousands of U.S. troops that lost their lives in Vietnam? And this is what Dr. Al-Hashimi had to say.
Who wants war? Who wants his country to be destroyed? But when somebody attacks your house or your home, those hoodlums or mafia or whatever, that just your human instinct will defend yourself, will defend your family, will defend your home. 12 years of suffering. That's great, 12 years of hate. And then anger. So imagine what a human being can do when he hates and he's angry. And that's what the Iraqi people will do if they see any American soldier in the streets.
In your article, Jeremy, titled Bush Corleone, Saddam Hussein Sleeps with the Fishes, you say that Bush is setting Saddam up to reject peace by pushing for a UN resolution that Saddam couldn't possibly agree with. What terms, in your opinion, would place the bar so high that Saddam would refuse to jump?
Basically, Verna, this document reads like an occupation agreement, and it's very similar to the piece of paper that Slobodan Milosevic of Yugoslavia was asked to sign prior to the NATO bombing there in 1999. Essentially, what the U.S. draft resolution that's being debated right now at the United Nations and is being torn apart by countries like South Africa and other countries that make up the non-aligned movement, what this resolution says is that Iraq needs to allow foreign troops, armed troops, to come into the country with weapons inspectors. No sovereign country is going to accept that. They're not being called peacekeepers. Quite simply, Tommy Franks could put on a UN uniform and walk into Baghdad and say, the Iraqis have no right to touch me, even though I'm the commander of enemy forces. There also is a clause in this resolution that I call the kidnap doctrine. The United States wants the right to take any Iraqi official or individual outside of the country to question them and to facilitate the transportation of their families outside of the country. This is like forced defection. They would simply be put on a plane and relocated to some European city to be interrogated by the United States. And finally, the United States reserves the right in their version of the draft resolution to send in a private team that is not working within the structure of the United Nations and to essentially have free reign of the country and have the same quote-unquote unfettered access as the United Nations weapons inspectors. This is an agreement that no country could possibly accept. And as one senior Iraqi politician told me, look, this is an occupation agreement, and we're not going to have anything to do with it. If it passes, we will not accept it.
Jeremy, what has made the biggest impression on you during your visit in Baghdad? Is there a feeling of impending war even beyond the never-ending bombing campaign? Is there this feeling of war in the air?
You know, Verna, something I think needs to be said is that when you push people's faces into the mud for 12 years, it's going to spark an extreme reaction. And what we're seeing inside of Iraq right now is an increased interest in religion. For instance, the largest group of Muslims in this country are the Shia Muslims. Iran is also a Shia Muslim country. The holiest imam in the Shia Muslim religion has called for jihad against the United States if American soldiers come into this country. The Shias are the people that the United States says are being repressed by Saddam Hussein, and yet the equivalent of the Pope of this religion has called for jihad against American soldiers. I think that you have a number of things that are very sad happening right now. People remember the pain of war, not just the war of sanctions and ongoing bombing, but the Gulf War. I talked to a man today who was telling me a story of how the woman who made his bread and lived in a tent, he would bring her flour every week for her to make his bread for him. That woman was killed during the Gulf War as she lived in her tent, a very poor, humble woman. He told me the story of a traffic guard that he would see every day and never exchanged words with, just friendly glances. That man was killed in the bombing as he was on his traffic stop. And so people know the pain of war. People are very, very afraid. But, Verna, they're also angry, and I think, unfortunately, they are ready for the possibility of a U.S. invasion. Everyone in this country has a gun. Everyone in this country has a gun. And if the U.S. tries to send people in here, we are looking at body bags galore coming back to the United States. And that has to be digested by every American right now who is saying, we want to go to war with Iraq, that it will put American forces in the middle of a country of 23 million guns.
And when you say that a jihad has been called for, that's pretty much a holy war against any American soldiers?
500 Islamic clergy have signed on to this, regardless of their opinions of Saddam Hussein, including clergy from other countries that would like nothing more than to see Saddam Hussein gone from power. They have signed on and said, if the United States attempts to occupy an Arab country like Iraq, that we call on all good Muslims to rise up in resistance and jihad against them. This is very, very significant. What that shows is that in the international chess game that was the last 12 years, Saddam Hussein has effectively showed that the United States is the chief oppressor in this region, that the United States has troops in the holy lands of Mecca and Medina, that the United States is sponsoring the slaughter of Palestinians on the part of Ariel Sharon and his government. It calls the question, and Verna, I have to say that Saddam Hussein, whether you like this statement or not, is the most popular leader in the Arab world today. I was in Jordan, which is an extremely pro-Western Arab country, and many, many people, intellectuals and wealthy people, as well as people on the streets, are saying that the strongest leader in the Arab world is Saddam Hussein because he stands up to Bush and to Ariel Sharon. This is the result of 12 years of punishing the Iraqi people in front of the eyes of the world.
Freelance journalist Jeremy Scahill speaking with us from Baghdad, Iraq. A coalition of veterans from the World War II, the Korean War, and the Gulf War picketed the White House this week. They came to urge the president to work with the United Nations and not wage war unilaterally, and spoke of their personal remembrances of the horrors of war as reasons to allow peace to prevail.
Harvard University graduates who served in World War II, joined by ex-Marines, veterans, and veteran historians of the Korean and Persian Gulf Wars, marched on the United States White House, calling themselves the Veterans Coalition for Sanity on Iraq, in uniform, old and young, women and men wearing their medals and holding placards that read, "Iraq, another Vietnam, the greater generation is ashamed, no war for oil." They insist that the U.S. president works only through the United Nations and through a united front with France, Germany, and other allies. They also brought to bear on the debate about a war against Iraq some of their experiences with the deceitfulness and horrors of war.
1, 2, 3, 4. We don't want another war.
I think it's madness. And war is killing. War is terrible. World War II was a beautiful war in many ways because we had a real reason to fight it. And people were being killed. It was an attack against civilians everywhere. The bombing of London was an example of this. And yes, he had to be stopped. He had to be stopped.
Isn't that the argument that they're building up against Saddam Hussein?
Well, but you know, who is he? You know, he doesn't present that much of a threat. He has maybe working toward weapons of mass destruction. Well, who else has weapons of mass destruction? China, India, Pakistan, Israel, the United States. I mean, if we're worried about weapons of mass destruction, there are plenty of other areas where our attention should be paid, I think. War is killing. War solves very little, very little. After war is over, we become friends with the enemy that we were just fighting. It's destructive of human life, but of property, of values, of everything, really.
One, two, three, four. We don't want another war.
The Greatest Generation is ashamed of this administration for its ideas of a preemptive strike and unilateral action. It's the wrong war. It's being approached the wrong way. It's arrogant.
One, two, three, four. We don't want another war.
My name is Robert Vandeveer. I'm a World War II veteran, a member of Veterans for Peace. Preemptive strike ideas are un-American. They're contrary to international law, and they're obscene. We're against them.
I'm Karen Johnson, veteran, spent 20 years in the Air Force, retired a few years ago, and having been through the Vietnam War and the Persian Gulf War, decided that it's really important for us to speak up when we are opposed to this war. We have not tried all the diplomatic methods to resolve the conflict we have between Iraq. The UN should be involved, and we need to be part of a global peace effort as opposed to working as Lone Rangers.
What is a weapon of mass destruction, in your opinion?
The weapon of mass destruction, in my opinion, is the Bush administration's focusing on Iraq as a terrorist nation that we need to attack and a threat to our security, as opposed to focusing on the economy and on the rights of the citizens of this nation, which are currently being eroded.
Ellen Barfield is the Vice President of Veterans for Peace.
Even veterans, or maybe especially veterans, because we know what war is about, don't want this coming war in Iraq.
One, two, three, four. We don't want another war.
I was born on an island called Manhattan 84 years ago, in Japanese American, in the United States Army a year before Pearl Harbor. And I was prevented from protecting New York Harbor because of my name.
One, two, three, four. We don't want another war.
I'm here because I'm a historian of veterans. I'm an author of a book called The New Winter Soldiers, a GI and veteran descent during the Vietnam era.
And your name is?
Richard Moser.
What is your take on the veterans marching against the war?
There is a history of veteran anti-war movements in the United States. From World War II, even World War I, all the way to the present, the Gulf War, certainly in Vietnam, veterans who experienced war came back very disillusioned with it and wanted peace for a whole variety of reasons. Largely was because they found out that the reasons they thought they were fighting for were not the motivations behind the war. You know, they went to fight for democracy and they found out, well, that's not really what this is about. And I can predict that if we invade Baghdad, if we try to invade and hold Iraq, that large numbers of American veterans, they will find out that we went there to get oil and to extend the power of the American empire and had very little to do with defending the United States or promoting democracy or freedom or anything like that.
Some people said that after the Vietnam War, in the training, the United States Army will tell them, very briefly, but still, they have the right to refuse what they consider unlawful orders. What is the support system for them when they choose to activate that right?
During the Gulf War in 91, a support network was sprouting up, even though it was a very short war. So there were a series of newspapers, GI newspapers, and GI support networks, of which I actually was a part of one in New Jersey. In these cases, there will be the development of support networks. There's a group in New York called Citizen Soldier that does this kind of work. So there are a few small organizations around that reach out to families and to soldiers. There was a group of families of Gulf War veterans that did work in supporting soldiers who might have had questions about the legality or morality of the war that they're involved in. And, of course, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, a veterans group, had a very, very excellent, well-put-together newspaper that was called The Winter Soldier, because they were trying to evoke Tom Paine's famous speech from the American Revolution about the Winter Soldier. So they actually looked back to the American Revolutionary tradition as a source of resistance to imperial war. So they, in a sense, were the true patriots, at least so I argue in my book. And I think that a very good argument can be made that at this point in our history, people who resist war are much truer patriots than people who support war.
What were some of the things that the Gulf War veterans are experiencing? We heard of the usage of a lot of chemical weapons there by the United States and exposure that both hit the Iraqi citizens but also the soldiers.
Yes. Now, I tell you, I'm no expert on the Gulf War syndrome, but I've been around veterans long enough to know that whether you start all the way back with the atomic veterans right after World War I, who we actually tested nuclear weapons on, there's a tendency in modern warfare for your own soldiers to be exposed to what some veterans call the toxicological cocktail, a mixture of toxic elements which can affect your health for the rest of your life, can actually affect, of course, the health of your children. So that children who aren't even alive during the war end up becoming casualties of a war. It's the most bizarre thing in the world. So, you know, so some Gulf War vet comes back, has a child, the child has birth defects. Well, that birth defect is technically a war injury, right? A casualty of the war. One of the thing that isn't discussed is the use of depleted uranium shells, that we use depleted uranium. It's a new form of nuclear weapon. It doesn't explode in a big mushroom cloud. It's a very hard metal that they use to pierce armor. But what it does is when it strikes a tank and burns, it leaves a circle of radioactive material that stays radioactive, you know, for 20,000 years. And so the American GIs in the Gulf War were climbing up on dead tanks, not knowing that the whole area was now hot with radioactivity. So we irradiated them as well as the shots and pills and the smoke from the burning oil wells and such. The other thing about the Gulf War that's important was the level of friendly fire, fratricide, the fact that in modern wars our weapons are so strong that we now kill an unprecedented level of our own people or our allies. For example, in the Gulf War, most of the English soldiers who were killed by American firepower. So as our weapons get stronger and stronger, the level of friendly fire also increases. Now, that it's jarring for people to understand that. It's not normally what people think about in war. But indeed, this level of fratricide in Iraq broke all records. It was the highest level yet. And if we go to Iraq this time, I can guarantee that we will kill our own soldiers in record percentages also.
As a veterans historian, have you also looked at the media coverage of the effects on the soldiers and these friendly fires?
Largely, it's ignored, I'm afraid. The whole friendly fire issue was pretty much left out of most media accounts of the war, particularly immediately after the war, because, as you probably know, there was a whole triumphal spirit about how wonderful the war was, and all of the countervailing information, like that the Patriot missiles didn't work, for example, and all that stuff, and the mass graves, and all, you know, that all dribbles out later and just doesn't have the same media impact. So I'm not sure how the coverage has been, administration, hospitals, and such. But for a lot of these things, there is simply no cure. You've had toxic exposure, and you can do all sorts of things to try and clean your system out, but no cure.
That segment was provided by WPFW's Reem Kathuta. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, Jennifer Harbury, Helen Caldicott, and a young spoken word artist named 13.